Riding. Resonance, London. Dilos Radio, Budapest. Radio Cult, Sofia. Radio Campus, Brussels. Reboot, Berlin. Orange, Vienna. Canal 103, Skopje. Riest, Lisbon. Kunstradio, Vienna. Radio.
Hidden Places, Iceland Edit, A Journey and Four Tales from Iceland, a combination of interviews and field recordings, a rough edit done high up in the sky at night, in an airplane heading back to Berlin, 7,000 kilometers above the sea, by Raw Audio.
Failed walk over the mountain to reach the dark earth, dressed in red, moisture blinded, blinking in self-defense. The body falls into hours of leaning against a rushing barrier, slow dancing around this impossible twist and peak. Below, four swans watch on.
There's a very small blue flower. Some call them the cat's eyes. Very, very, very blue and very small. And it has four petals, very small. And you can only see them when the grass is very short. And they blink from the ground. They are so blue. But if you touch them, they close. So it's a really wonderful flower.
But you can't touch it.
I can touch it, but then it closes.
I walked along the river to the waterfall, and I wasn't clear if it was the waterfall that Lillian had told us about. But anyway, I decided to go up on the top, going to try to walk back here. And unfortunately, I didn't quite make it because I came across the crevasse. So I walked along, I'm pretty sure it was the crevasse, but it was filled with snow. Yeah, and then I walked back here. Come back down again across the river, down to the river, and then walk back the same way. But the thing that struck me about the crevasse was that it is a very hidden place, because you have this big area. It looks like, at the moment, because it's been snowing, it looks like a kind of snow river or something, and you don't really know how deep it goes. Or I mean, I didn't go anywhere near the edge. I'm much too scared. You can walk round it one way, but it seemed too far to go that way. So I walked back towards the farm. And eventually I did come to the end of the crevasse. And I was really pleased that I hadn't tried to cross it, because it was incredibly deep. I was tempted to, I thought, if I just go a little bit further, you know, and just see if I can put my feet in the first little bit of snow. I mean, I was attracted to it because I wanted to know what was underneath the snow, what the landscape was like and what the rocks were like and what was hidden there, how steep it was. Because it looked so solid, but then I was remembering Haldor saying, don't try and cross anything like that, because it's likely that it will be deep. I don't know how long it is. I mean, I walked alongside it for a good, probably 200 metres where I was. It was getting wider, but for the first bit, it was probably about 20 metres across. You know, no, it had time to go down and come back up again, so maybe it was a bit more than that. They do have a strong attraction. I think possibly it's wanting to see because you can't see. And then there's also the element of danger, which is quite a strong magnetic pull towards it. I mean, akin to that feeling where when you're on the edge of a cliff, you think, I could throw myself off. There's that aspect to it. So I think, yeah, there was quite a strong pull. I mean, I wanted to, you know, to walk along beside it, and my eyes were fixed to it, trying to work out what was happening. What does it remind me of? It did bring to mind, actually, when I was about 18, I went on a mountain climbing tour with a group of other young adults, about 60 of us, with the staff that took us to the Alps, and we walked on the glaciers there, and we used to have to get up at 4 a.m, because if you walked on the glaciers past about noon or 1 o'clock, the crevasses, the ice covering the crevasses melted, so you could just slide down. One time we were up on top of the crevasse, and we went to the mountain hut where we'd hoped we could stay, but it was full, so we couldn't stay there, and we had to come back down again, so we were all roped together, and one of our party did in fact step on the snow, and it turned out to be a crevasse, and he didn't go very far, but it's quite shocking. It's that feeling where you think this is solid ground, and then suddenly it isn't. I mean, it wasn't a very steep bit that he, but when he stood on it, the rest of the snow broke away and we could see the extent of it. So when I saw that crevasse, it definitely brought to mind that experience from when I was 18. So to the north, I'm standing with my feet at the edge of the crevasse, and it is going in a horizontal line from left to right in front of me. So for the first 20 metres, I can just see the snow covering the crevasse, and then the snowy hillside beyond that, and then nothing really. There's just mountains in the distance and other kind of snowy peaks, and maybe just a hint of the top of the glacier in that direction. And then if I turn 90 degrees and go to the south, I'm facing where the glacier, where the crevasse ends and comes out into the river. So I can see the river in front of me. The crevasse is now on my left. It's down quite a bit of a cliff. I had to get down to come back to the farm. And the river is now going horizontally across. And on the right of the side of my field of vision, I can see a little waterfall. And the cliffs are black, and there's bits of snow in them. And then just in the distance, there's a farmhouse, which is their neighbour's farmhouse across the other side. And then if I turn 90 degrees again and look south, in the field of vision on my left, the river is kind of snaking along until it gets lost in between the hillsides. And there's, in this direction, there's lots of snow, and the highlands go on and on and on until there's a peak, just that single peak in the distance. There's lots of snow, lots of moorland, lots of sky. And it's windy, and there's lots of moss that's close to me as well. And then if I turn 90 degrees, so I'm now facing west, I'm looking up the direction that the crevasse came from. And that was the view that I took, so I can see this kind of line of snow going off into the distance, set amongst the snowy hillsides. And that was the view I took when I was debating whether or not I should walk round it, or whether or not I should in fact go the other way and climb down the cliff and come back alongside the river. The sounds, yeah, lots of wind sounds. Occasionally, 2 or 3 times maybe, I heard the sound of the whooper swans above me as they flew over my head. Just about here, the sound of the river and the rushing, because it's flowing very fast there, and I was just at the top of the cliff there. It varied in intensity. It wasn't actually too bad when I was out, but also because I had my hood up, now and again it did this very compact little bits of snow, not big lush fat snowflakes, but almost like weeny bits of hail, and blown against my hood, so I could hear the sound of I could hear the sound of the hail hitting my hood as well. And in fact, when that was happening, that was blowing from this direction. I couldn't turn my face to the wind because it was too painful. The sound of the water is very busy. It's rushing. It's fast-flowing water, rushing over stones, gurgling, brewing. The water was, most of the time, it was beside me, on my left. So the sound my feet made, crunching in the snow, and then because the rocks around here are so distinct and sharp, sometimes when you're walking on a little mound and you dislodge several of them, they've got a really high-pitched, almost tinny sound as they clatter together and they fall down the little mound. And it reminds me a little bit of the sound that ice makes when it just when you first put it in a gin and tonic and it does that little clink and starts to melt, the first crack in the ice when it starts to melt, it's a very kind of high-pitched little clink. And these rocks are quite high-pitched. I liked the sound, actually, so I stopped and so that I could hear it.
In many parts of the country, elves live in the rocks and the stones up on the surface. But in this cave, in this particular cave, which is the largest underground space that we know of, so maybe that is the reason, that there is a special type of elves that aren't found anywhere else on the island, and they're called ice elves. And they're called like that simply because they live not in the rocks and the stones, but in the ice formations that get created there every winter with dripping of water and freezing cold floor. These are like ice towers that accumulate there in one area and form what we call Ice Elf City, many, many towers like that. So they come every winter and stay there, and we are very careful with this space. We don't want to harm this city, this home. And that's what this belief is all about. It's about having respect for the nature, to think twice before you do anything in the nature, to think that you might not only be just, you know, harming something, but someone. The cave is over 1,000 years old, but some hundreds of years after the cave was formed, it started to get this ice when it had cooled down enough. You know, there was no ice being created when it was still warm. So for some hundreds of years, this has been the case. The elves, these ice elves, probably at one point found this cave and decided to stay there, at least for the winters, because that's when the ice gets created. It melts every summer, grows every winter. So it's a peaceful place, and especially in the old times. Now, there's of course more people visiting things like this, like caves and these natural things. But we do protect the cave and preserve it, so it doesn't get too much traffic or too many visitors through, or it's not too much bother for the ice elves during the winter. Then in the summer, they move. When the palace of the king and queen of the ice elves, when it breaks, that's always the point when they move away for the summer, most likely to the glacier.
At what time of the year do they leave?
That's like in May, maybe end of May sometimes. It slowly melts away, but a few formations, they melt first at the bottom, so it's a tower of ice. In the case of the palace, as we call it, it's a 2 meter tall tower of ice that first starts to melt at the bottom for some reason, and until it's like a big tower of ice standing on a needle-thin, really, piece of ice, and then eventually from one moment to the next, it cracks from its own weight and faults and breaks. And that's the point, even if not all the rest of the formations have melted, that's the point where the whole population of the ice elves moves away for the summer. But then slowly all the ice just keeps on melting or breaking.
This was a almost completely black landscape, very industrial in a way, and sort of remote in its kind of, there wasn't really a human element to it apart from some signposts and a road. The river and the road were, no, actually on this point the river was very blue, but there's sort of the river is running through this black landscape with piles of, it's not gravel, but things that they use for gravel. I liked it because it's all kind of gathered waste material or gathered debris, just like the small bits that have been swept up and they're going to be used for something. And you imagine that the landscape is continually producing this when you look at the hills that are surrounding and the amount of rock that's slowly falling and slowly obviously breaking down. You think that that kind of thing is not mined. It didn't seem to be mined from there. You weren't digging it out of the land. It was just sort of accumulating on, and they were sort of sweeping it up over time and making use of it. I liked those mountains because I felt that they could be, yeah, they were just heaps of material which allows you to play in a different way. And it's like it's got a weight and a density to it, so it can take you as well as you can take it. So you can physically interact with that. There's a road leading ahead, and there's a yellow sign, like triangle-shaped sign with a red border. So the road leads through this landscape up into the further highlands, and there's a glacier ahead. The mountains are black. The glacier is white. The sky is blue. And then down closer, we have these two or three of these, they're almost like rooftops of small rocks piled up, but there's no trucks around to take them away. And there's no heavy machinery, and there's no tools, and there's no working people. There's just piles that have been at some point collected. But it's not much ahead of me. It's maybe 20 meters away from me, to the north, the first rooftop of rocks, black rocks. So further to the west, if I turn around, there's a river that runs past. And the landscape is completely these little rocks anyway, so that they sort of fall down into this river, and the river's quite... if you weren't in Iceland, if you were in England and you saw a river this colour blue, it would be a little bit disturbing, that kind of blue, because it seems unnatural. And because it comes down from the glacier, I think you shouldn't drink the water or swim in the water, because you never know what was happening in the environment, or in the environment at that point in time. Like, it could have been an explosion where certain gases were let off, and then they froze in the ice, and so the ice takes you back to multiple potentials of historical time. It's kind of off bounds, that river, but it does sort of weave through the black in a very iridescent, beautiful blue.
It's amazing what a place between those mounts in the grass, just lying between the mounts, and nobody sees you, but you can see the sky and hear everything and hear the birds and lie just still. That was when I was young, what I did. But when I was older, I started going... Just looking in the lava, I liked a lot to walk in the lava and find some new places where maybe there was one fern or something. And part of going back and try to find it was always a pleasure. In this landscape, you can there are so many places that you can find and lose again. The small places. You have to go every day to some place in the lava to really know it. My favorite was going berry picking, blueberry picking. And I could go in the morning and not come back until evening, when I was maybe 10. So blueberry picking and having my own places to pick the berries is maybe the most thrill of it. And from here we can see one of these places. In the field here, this was the furthest meadow from our home. And we did go and make the grass here. Maybe late in August, when we were fetching the hay, I was raking up the rests, and then I did go and lose myself somewhere in there berry picking, and I often slept also. If the weather was good, I lay on the moss and slept. This is a very happy memories. And all the berry picking memories are so good. Still, I don't know anything better than picking berries. Blueberries, yes.
The place that I'm in is, the type of landscape is called an Icelandic laut. It's kind of in a hill, and it's, if you imagine that like a giant sat down there and made this like butt-shaped form into the hill. So it has, the general area is a hill, but then there is, you know, a little extra hill on your right, another hill on your left, and behind you, a half bowl kind of, and it's always very peaceful there. It's fully grown with grass. It's not rocks and stones or anything, so that makes it very warm and shelter, like a feeling of shelter. And there's a little stream of water nearby as well. And looking to either side, northeast and south, really, is just the grass, like this, because I'm inside this space. But then looking out, I basically see to the west a bit of a field, small trees that we've planted here, the field that then meets with field of grass that meets with the river, and on the other side the hills of the joining farm, the other farm on the other side of the river. And I think I see his houses and sheep houses and all that from there. I don't see the long view, so it's not as open as here on the farm, but it's still safer. It's beginning. I know that around the corner of this grass, there's a big view.
Ke eredutse ile sun te ima ni betin che dure. C'est ici que, sur la terre, je m'approche du ciel et regarde la terre.
The hidden people, or the trolls, are there.
We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week, we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.